Chapter 41. This purpose and this peace runs through four centuries, in as many acts, describing the agonies and unavailing attempts of the miserable Dutchman. Willing to go any lengths in order to obtain his prayer, he, in the second act, betrays a virgin of the sun to a follower of Pizarro, and, in the third, assassinates the heroic William of Nassau. But ever before the dropping of the curtain, the angel and sword make their appearance. Reakery, says the spirit, cannot lessen thy punishment. Crime will not obtain thy release. A lamer. And the poor devil returns to the ocean, to be lonely, and tempest-tossed, and seasick for 100 years more. But his woes are destined to end with the fourth act. Having landed in America, where the peasants on the seashore, all dressed in Italian costumes, are celebrating, in a quadrille, the victories of Washington, he is there lucky enough to find a young girl to pray for him. Then the curse is removed, the punishment is over, and a celestial vessel, with angels on the decks and wheat little cherubs fluttering about the shrouds and the poop, appear to receive him. This piece was acted at Franconi's, where, for once, an angel ship was introduced in place of the usual horsemanship. One must not forget to mention here how the English nation is satirized by our neighbors, who have some droll traditions regarding us. In one of the little Christmas pieces produced at the Palace Royal, satires upon the follies of the past 12 months, on which all the small theaters exhaust their wit, the celebrated flight of Messrs. Green and Mongmason was parodied, and created a good deal of laughter at the expense of John Bull. Two English noblemen, Miler Crickry and Miler Hanton, appear as descending from a balloon, and one of them communicates to the public the philosophic observations which were made in the course of his aerial tour. On leaving Vauxhall, says his lordship, we drank a bottle of Madeira as a health to the friends from whom we parted, and crunched a few biscuits to support nature during the hours before lunch. In 2 hours we arrived at Canterbury, enveloped in clouds. Lunch, bottled porter. A Dover, carried several miles in a tide of air, bitter cold, cherry brandy, crossed over the channel safely, and thought with pity of the poor people who were sickening in the steamboats below. More bottled porter. Over Calais, dinner, roast beef of old England. Near Dunkirk, night falling, lunar rainbow, brandy and water, night confoundedly thick, supper, nightcap of rum punch, and so to bed. The sun broke beautifully through the morning mist, as we boiled the kettle, and took our breakfast over Cologne. In a few more hours we concluded this memorable voyage, and landed safely at Weilburg, in good time for dinner. The joke here is smart enough, but our honest neighbors make many better, when they are quite unconscious of the fun. Let us leave plays, for a moment, for poetry, and take an instance of French criticism concerning England, from the works of a famous French exquisite and man of letters. The hero of the poem addresses his mistress, Londres, to la Sastrop, en fait de capitale, est ce que fit la ciel de plus froid et plus pale, qu'est la ville du gaz, des marins, du brouillard, en si couche a minuit, et l'on si leave tard. Ces rats tant vans ni sont qu'une boxade, sur ces crans quais jamais se chel ou serenade, mais de voluminu bourgeois prista porter qui passant sans lever la front de Westminster, et netit sa fort de mats perkin la broom, sa tour dans de minuit la vie l'el salium, et test du you, zerline, illumins bean plus, g dires que, ma foi, de romans que ja I lus, il n'en est pas un soul, plus lord, plus lethargy, K set nation Q nom Britannique. The writer of the above lines, which let any man who can translate, is Monsieur Roger de Beauvoir, a gentleman who actually lived many months in England, as an attaché to the embassy of M. de Polignac. He places the heroine of his tale in a petit redoux at Press-le-Strand, with a green and fresh jalousie, and a large blind, let down all day. You fancied you were entering a bath of Asia, as soon as you had passed the perfumed threshold of this charming retreat. He next places her, dams on Square Eckert, Mornay Calvert the Giver, UC Catchon Hotel, Oxview Lions the Cover. And the hero of the tale, a young French poet, who is in London, is truly unhappy in that village. Arthur Desechet Muirt. Dans la ville de Stern, Rien que en voyant la pupille et la mal de mer il ne mène le parc, gai comme une citerne, en I la tour au pigeon, en I la soda water. Listen ni la fête plus sourciller. Il rumen sur les trottoirs du strand, droit comme un échiquier, contre la pupille anglais, les neigers, la vermin, et les mille cockneys du pupille baudiquier, contre tous les bas blues. Contre les pâtissiers, les perrures d'Epsom, la gin, la Perlmont, la Quaterly, la Roy, la Pluie et les libraires, dont il n'y touche plus, heels, un sou d'argent. Et chaque gentleman lui dit, lui repeat indeed. I question if a poet in this wide world is so happy as M. de Beauvoir, or has made such wonderful discoveries. He bath of Asia, with green jalousies, in which the lady dwells, the old hotel, with copper lions, in a lonely square, wherever such things heard of, or imagined, but by a Frenchman. The sailors, the negroes, the vermin, whom he meets in the street, how great and happy are all these discoveries. Liston no longer makes the happy poet frown, and, in, Cockneys, and the Quaterly have not the least effect upon him. And this gentleman has lived many months amongst us, admires William Shakespeare, the Graveview Prophet, as he calls him, and never, for an instant, doubts that his description contains anything absurd. I don't know whether the great Dumas has passed any time in England, but his plays show a similar intimate knowledge of our habits. Thus in Keane, the stage manager is made to come forward and address the pit with a speech beginning, "My lords and gentlemen," and a company of English women are introduced at the memorable Old Hall, and they all wear pinafores, as if the British female were in the invariable habit of wearing this outer garment or slobbering her gown without it. There was another celebrated piece, enacted some years since, upon the subject of Queen Caroline, where our late adored sovereign, George, was made to play a most despicable part, and where Signor Bergamai fought a duel with Lord Londonderry. In the last act of this play, the House of Lords was represented, and Sir Brougham made an eloquent speech in the Queen's favor. Presently the shouts of the mob were heard without. From shouting they proceeded to pelting, and pasteboard brickbats and cabbages came flying among the representatives of our hereditary legislature. At this unpleasant juncture, Sir Hardinge, the Secretary at War, rises and calls in the military. The act ends in a general row, and the ignominious fall of Lord Liverpool, laid low by a brickbat from the mob. The description of these scenes is, of course, quite incapable of conveying any notion of their general effect. You must have the solemnity of the actors, as they meet and mire one another, and the perfect gravity and good faith with which the audience listen to them. Our stage Frenchman is the old Marquis, with sword, and pigtail, and spangled court coat. The Englishman of the French theater has, invariably, a red wig, and almost always leather gaiters, and a long white upper benjamin. He remains as he was represented in the old caricatures after the piece, when Vernet designed him. And to conclude this catalogue of blunders, in the famous piece of the Offrage de la Méduse, the first act is laid on board an English ship of war, all the officers of which appeared in light blue or green coats. The lamplight prevented our distinguishing the color accurately, and top boots. Let us not attempt to deaden the force of this tremendous blow by any more remarks. The force of blundering can go no further. Would a Chinese playwright or painter have stranger notions about the barbarians than our neighbors, who are separated from us, but by 2 hours of salt water? Meditations at Versailles. The Palace of Versailles has been turned into a bric-a-brac shop of late years, and its time-honored walls have been covered with many thousand yards of the worst pictures that I ever looked on. I don't know how many leagues of battles and sieges the unhappy visitor is now obliged to march through, amidst a crowd of chattering Paris cockneys, who are never tired of looking at the glories of the Grenadier Francaise, to the chronicling of whose deeds this old palace of the old kings is now altogether devoted. A whizzing, screaming steam engine rushes hither from Paris, bringing shoals of badauds in its wake. The old Caucasus are all gone, and their place knows them no longer. Smooth asphaltum terraces, tawdry lamps, and great hideous Egyptian obelisks have frightened them away from the pleasant station they used to occupy under the trees of the Champs-Élysées, and though the old Caucasus were just the most uncomfortable vehicles that human ingenuity ever constructed, one can't help looking back to the days of their existence with a tender regret. For there was pleasure then in the little trip of 3 leagues. And whoever had pleasure in a railway journey? Does any reader of this venture to say that, on such a voyage, he ever dared to be pleasant? Do the most hardened stokers joke with one another? I don't believe it. Look into every single car of the train, and you will see that every single face is solemn. They take their seats gravely, and are silent, for the most part, during the journey. They dare not look out of window, for fear of being blinded by the smoke that comes whizzing by, or of losing their heads in one of the windows of the down train. They ride for miles in utter damp and darkness, through awful pipes of brick that have been run pitilessly through the bowels of gentle Mother Earth. The cast-iron Frankenstein of an engine gallops on, puffing and screaming. Does any man pretend to say that he enjoys the journey? He might as well say that he enjoyed having his hair cut. He bears it, but that is all. He will not allow the world to laugh at him for any exhibition of slavish fear, and pretends, therefore, to be at his ease, but he is afraid. Nay, ought to be, under the circumstances. I am sure Hannibal or Napoleon would, were they locked suddenly into a car. They're kept close prisoners for a certain number of hours, and whirled along at this dizzy pace. You can't stop, if you would. You may die, but you can't stop. The engine may explode upon the road, and up you go along with it, or maybe a bolter and take a fancy to go down a hill or into a river. All this you must bear for the privilege of traveling 20 miles an hour. This little journey, then, from Paris to Versailles, that used to be so merry of old, has lost its pleasure since the disappearance of the Caucasus, and I would as lief have for companions the statues that lately took a coach from the bridge opposite the Chamber of Deputies, and stepped out in the court of Versailles, as the most part of the people who now travel on the railroad. The stone figures are not a whit more cold and silent than these persons, who used to be, in the old Caucasus, so talkative and merry. The prattling grisette and her swain from the Ecole de Droit, the huge Alsatian carabineer, grimly smiling under his sandy mustaches and glittering brass helmet, the jolly nurse, in red calico, who had been to Paris, to show Mama her darling Lolo, or August. What merry companions used one to find squeezed into the crazy old vehicles that formerly performed the journey. But the age of horseflesh is gone, that of engineers, economists, and calculators has succeeded, and the pleasure of Calcutum is extinguished forever. Why not mourn over it, as Mr. Burke did over his cheap Defense of Nations and Unbought Grace of Life? That age of chivalry, which he lamented, apropos of a trip to Versailles, some half a century back? Without stopping to discuss, as might be done, in rather a neat and successful manner, whether the age of chivalry was cheap or dear, and whether, in the time of the unbought grace of life, there was not more bribery, robbery, villainy, tyranny, and corruption than exists even in our own happy days, let us make a few moral and historical remarks upon the town of Versailles, where, between railroad and Caucasus, we are surely arrived by this time. The town is, certainly, the most moral of towns. You pass from the railroad station through a long, lonely suburb, with moldy rows of stunted trees on either side, and some few miserable beggars, idle boys, and ragged old women under them. Behind the trees are gaunt, moldy houses, palaces once, where in the days of the unbought grace of life, the cheap defense of nations gambled, ogled, swindled, intrigued. Whence high-born duchesses used to issue, in old times, to act as chambermaids to lovely Dewberry, and mighty princes rolled away, in gilt carriages, hot for the honor of lighting his majesty to bed, or of presenting his stockings when he rose, or of holding his napkin when he dined. Tailors, chandlers, tinmen, wretched hucksters, and greengrocers, are now established in the mansions of the old peers. Small children are yelling at the doors, with mouths besmeared with bread and treacle. Damp rags are hanging out of every one of the windows, steaming in the sun. Oyster shells, cabbage stalks, broken crockery, old papers, lie basking in the same cheerful light. A solitary water cart goes jingling down the wide pavement, and spurts a feeble refreshment over the moldy, thirsty stones. After pacing for some time through such dismal streets, we debouchure on the grand place, and before us lies the palace dedicated to all the glories of France. In the midst of the great lonely plain, this famous residence of King Louis looks low and mean. Honored pile! Time was when tall musketeers and gilded bodyguards allowed none to pass the gate. 50 years ago, 10,000 drunken women from Paris broke through the charm, and now a tattered commissioner will conduct you through it for a penny, and lead you up to the sacred entrance of the palace. We will not examine all the glories of France, as here they are portrayed in pictures and marble. Catalogues are written about these miles of canvas, representing all the revolutionary battles, from Vimy to Waterloo, all the triumphs of Louis XIV, all the mistresses of his successor, and all the great men who have flourished since the French Empire began. Military heroes are most of these fierce constables in shining steel, marshals in voluminous wigs, and brave grenadiers in bearskin caps, some dozens of whom gained crowns, principalities, dukedoms, some hundreds, plunder and epaulets, some millions, death in African sands, or in icy Russian plains, under the guidance, and for the good, of that arch-hero, Napoleon. By far the greater part of the glories of France, as of most other countries, is made up of these military men. And a fine satire it is on the cowardice of mankind, that they pay such an extraordinary homage to the virtue called courage, filling their history books with tales about it, and nothing but it. Let them disguise the place, however, as they will, and plaster the walls with bad pictures as they please, it will be hard to think of any family but one, as one traverses this vast gloomy edifice. It has not been humbled to the ground, as a certain palace of Babel was of yore, but it is a monument of fallen pride, not less awful, and would afford matter for a whole library of sermons. The cheap Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.